Because the television commercial is the single most voluminous form of public communication in our society, it was inevitable that Americans would accommodate themselves to the philosophy of television commercials. By accommodate, I mean that we accept them as a normal and plausible form of discourse. By philosophy, I mean that the television commercial has embedded in it certain assumptions about the nature of communication that run counter to those of other media, especially the printed word. For one thing, the commercial insists on an unprecedented brevity of expression. One may even say, instancy. A 60-second commercial is prolix. 30 seconds is longer than most. 15 to 20 seconds is about average. This is a brash and startling structure for communication, since, as I remarked earlier, the commercial always addresses itself to the psychological needs of the viewer. Thus, it is not merely therapy, it is instant therapy. Indeed, it puts forward a psychological theory of unique axioms. The commercial asks us to believe that all problems are solvable, that they are solvable fast, and that they are solvable fast through the interventions of technology, techniques, and chemistry. This is, of course, a preposterous theory about the roots of discontent, and would appear so to anyone hearing or reading it. But the commercial disdains exposition, for that takes time, and invites argument. It is a very bad commercial indeed that engages the viewer in wondering about the validity of the point being made. That is why most commercials use the literary device of the pseudo-parable as a means of doing their work. Such parables as The Ring Around the Collar, The Lost Traveler's Checks, and The Phone Call from the Sun Far Away not only have irrefutable emotional power, but, like biblical parables, are unambiguously didactic. The television commercial is about products only in the sense that the story of Jonah is about the anatomy of whales, which is to say, it isn't. Which is to say further, it is about how one ought to live one's life. Moreover, commercials have the advantage of vivid visual symbols through which we may easily learn the lessons being taught. Among those lessons are that short and simple messages are preferable to long and complex ones, that drama is to be preferred over exposition, that being sold solutions is better than being confronted with questions about problems. Such beliefs would naturally have implications for our orientation to political discourse. That is to say, we may begin to accept as normal certain assumptions about the political domain that either derive from or are amplified by the television commercial. For example, a person who has seen 1 million television commercials might well believe that all political problems have fast solutions through simple measures, or ought to, or that complex language is not to be trusted, and that all problems lend themselves to theatrical expression, or that argument is in bad taste and leads only to an intolerable uncertainty. Such a person may also come to believe that it is not necessary to draw any line between politics and other forms of social life. Just as a television commercial will use an athlete, an actor, a musician, a novelist, a scientist, or a countess to speak for the virtues of a product in no way within their domain of expertise, television also frees politicians from the limited field of their own expertise. Political figures may show up anywhere, at any time, doing anything, without being thought odd, presumptuous, or in any way out of place. Which is to say, they have become assimilated into the general television culture as celebrities. Being a celebrity is quite different from being well known. Harry Truman was well known, but he was not a celebrity. Whenever the public saw him or heard him, Truman was talking politics. It takes a very rich imagination to envision Harry Truman, or for that matter, his wife, making a guest appearance on The Goldbergs or I Remember Mama. Politics and politicians had nothing to do with these shows, which people watched for amusement, not to familiarize themselves with political candidates and issues. It is difficult to say exactly when politicians began to put themselves forward intentionally as sources of amusement. In the 1950s, Senator Everett Dirksen appeared as a guest on What's My Line? When he was running for office, John F. Kennedy allowed the television cameras of Ed Murrow's Person to Person to invade his home. When he was not running for office, Richard Nixon appeared for a few seconds on Laugh-In, an hour-long comedy show based on the format of a television commercial. By the 1970s, the public had started to become accustomed to the notion that political figures were to be taken as part of the world of show business. In the 1980s came the deluge. Vice presidential candidate William Miller did a commercial for American Express. So did the star of the Watergate hearings, Senator Sam Ervin. Former President Gerald Ford joined with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger for brief roles on Dynasty. Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis appeared on St. Elsewhere. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill did a stint on Cheers. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader, George McGovern, and Mayor Edward Koch hosted Saturday Night Live. Koch also played the role of a fight manager in a made-for-television movie starring James Cagney. Mrs. Nancy Reagan appeared on Different Strokes. Would anyone be surprised if Gary Hart turned up on Hill Street Blues, or if Geraldine Ferraro played a small role as a Queens housewife in a Francis Coppola film? Although it may go too far to say that the politician as celebrity has, by itself, made political parties irrelevant, there is certainly a conspicuous correlation between the rise of the former and the decline of the latter. Some readers may remember when voters barely knew who the candidate was and, in any case, were not preoccupied with his character and personal life. As a young man, I balked one November at voting for a Democratic mayoralty candidate who, it seemed to me, was both unintelligent and corrupt. "What has that to do with it?" my father protested. "All Democratic candidates are unintelligent and corrupt. Do you want the Republicans to win?" He meant to say that intelligent voters favored the party that best represented their economic interests and sociological perspective. To vote for the best man seemed to him an astounding and naive irrelevance. He never doubted that there were good men among Republicans. He merely understood that they did not speak for his class. He shared with an unfailing eye the perspective of Big Tim Sullivan, a leader of New York's Tammany Hall in its glory days. As Terrence Moran recounts in his essay Politics 1984, Sullivan was once displeased when brought the news that the vote in his precinct was 6,382 for the Democrat and 2 for the Republican. In evaluating this disappointing result, Sullivan remarked, "Sure, didn't Kelly come to me to say his wife's cousin was running on the Republican line, and didn't I, in the interests of domestic tranquility, give him leave to vote Republican? But what I want to know is, who else voted Republican?" I will not argue here the wisdom of this point of view. There may be a case for choosing the best man over party, although I know of none. The point is that television does not reveal who the best man is. In fact, television makes impossible the determination of who is better than whom. If we mean by better such things as more capable in negotiation, more imaginative in executive skill, more knowledgeable about international affairs, more understanding of the interrelations of economic systems, and so on. The reason has almost entirely to do with image, but not because politicians are preoccupied with presenting themselves in the best possible light. After all, who isn't? It is a rare and deeply disturbed person who does not wish to project a favorable image. But television gives image a bad name, for on television the politician does not so much offer the audience an image of himself as offer himself as an image of the audience. And therein lies one of the most powerful influences of the television commercial on political discourse. To understand how image politics works on television, we may use as an entry point the well-known commercial from which this chapter takes the first half of its title. I refer to the Bell Telephone romances created by Mr. Steve Horn, in which we are urged to reach out and touch someone. The someone is usually a relative who lives in Denver or Los Angeles or Atlanta, in any case very far from where we are, and who in a good year we will be lucky to see on Thanksgiving Day. The someone used to play a daily and vital role in our lives, that is to say, used to be a member of the family. Though American culture stands vigorously opposed to the idea of family, there nonetheless still exists a residual nag that something essential to our lives is lost when we give it up. Enter Mr. Horn's commercials. These are 30-second homilies concerned to provide a new definition of intimacy in which the telephone wire will take the place of old-fashioned co-presence. Even further, these commercials intimate a new conception of family cohesion for a nation of kinsmen who have been split asunder by automobiles, jet aircraft, and other instruments of family suicide. In analyzing these commercials, Jay Rosen makes the following observation. Horn isn't interested in saying anything. He has no message to get across. His goal is not to provide information about Bell, but to somehow bring out from the broken ties of millions of American lives a feeling which might focus on the telephone. Horn does not express himself. You do not express yourself. Horn expresses you. This is the lesson of all great television commercials. They provide a slogan, a symbol, or a focus that creates for viewers a comprehensive and compelling image of themselves. In the shift from party politics to television politics, the same goal is sought. We are not permitted to know who is best at being president or governor or senator, but whose image is best in touching and soothing the deep reaches of our discontent. We look at the television screen and ask, in the same voracious way as the Queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?" We are inclined to vote for those whose personality, family life, and style, as imaged on the screen, give back a better answer than the Queen received.